Hello, I am Emma, the 11th Duchess of Rutland, and this is Duchess, a podcast in which I explore the most historic homes of the UK and meet the inspiring women who lead them. As a daughter of a Welsh farmer, I grew up far away from the glamour and wealth of aristocracy, but my life changed forever when I fell in love and married my husband, the 11th Duke of Rutland. Suddenly, one of Britain's most historic buildings was not only my home, but under my care. I wanted to hear the stories of other women like me, the custodians of these great homes. So in this podcast, I will travel to breathtaking homes and meet the inspiring women who lead these estates today. Please join me on this special journey. This is Duchess, the podcast. Nestled in Perthshire, gateway to the Highlands, sits an ancient royal palace that has become a defining symbol for Scottish national identity, Scone Palace. Constructed in red sandstone with a castellated roof, Scone is one of the finest examples of late Georgian Gothic architecture. The broad towered facade of the castle is in keeping with the classic and monastic history of Scone as an estate site on a sacred land. Once an ancient gathering site for the Picts, Scone Palace is the home of Moot Hill, where for 1,000 years all Scottish kings were crowned. Scone Palace was also the seat of the first Scottish Parliament and is now one of the most important tourist and historical sites in Europe. This week, I will meet Lady Mansfield, the exceptional woman who presides over this illustrious palace today. Lady Mansfield and her husband, the 9th Earl, are the latest in a 400-year line of custodians, as the Murrays have lived here within Scone Palace walls since 1604. With Lady Mansfield at my side, we will journey back through the history of Scone right to this present day. As a consequence of the UK lockdown, this episode was recorded remotely. I am very excited because today, listeners, I am with the Countess of Mansfield at Scone Palace. Now, Scone is actually spelt, it's rather like Beaver, our home, which is spelt to the readers, they would say Belvoir. It looks as if I should pronounce your palace Scone Palace.
Absolutely. And in the past, it was spelt in lots of different ways, often sometimes with an S and a K.
And do you have any connection, Sophie, with the scone at Scone?
Apart from the fact that I like eating them and I can bake them too. No.
No real connection between the scone and Scone. Just tell us where exactly Scone Palace is.
Scone is on the River Tay. It's just on the other side of the river to Perth.
And the Tay runs right in front of your home, if I remember.
Yes, the Tay does. And it starts up in the Highlands and it comes out at Dundee.
Perfect.
It's the river above the Forth, which is the one next door to Edinburgh.
So Scone has been home to the Murrays, I believe, since 1604. Could you give us a little insight into the Murray lineage and speak about some of the most famous figures in the palace's history?
Well, it all started with Feskin of Moravia, who was Flemish, who was the original Murray. And by the time we got down to 1604, my husband's ancestor was James VI's first cupbearer, but also he was his head of security. And there was a famous incident in Scotland called the Garrie Conspiracy. Lord Garrie and his family attempted to murder the king, and David Murray saved the king's life. And as a thank you, the king gave David Murray the lands of Scone, which he had previously given to the Garries.
What date was that, Sophie?
About 1604. And the family have been here ever since.
Amazing. And there was a very, very famous member of your family. Was he the first Earl of Mansfield?
Yes, the first Earl of Mansfield, his story is amazing. He was born in 1705, one of 13 children. And at the time, the family were struggling with Jacobite rebellions, and they had paid lots of fines because they had sided with the wrong side. And he was very bright. He was at Perth Grammar School, but he was luckily able to go to London and be educated in London. He got to London by being taken by a family retainer over to Dumfriesshire on a pony. And from Dumfriesshire, which is in the northwest of Scotland, just above Carlisle, he walked to London. It took him 57 days. When he got to London, he went to Westminster School, where he had a scholarship. And when he left Westminster School, he wanted to go to Oxford University. He couldn't afford the fees at Oxford University. And his friend from school's father, Lord Foley, paid for him to go to Christ Church at Oxford. And he went to Christ Church, spent 4 years there, and then joined Lincoln's Inn and became one of the most famous lawyers of all time.
Goodness. And he had a rather extraordinary wife, is that right?
I think she was very sort of progressive in her outlook in life. From a woman's point of view, they were probably most famous for adopting their nephew's illegitimate child, Dido Bell, who was born from a liaison with a slave. It goes back to the first Earl's nephew, Sir John Lindsay, was in the Navy, and he captured a Spanish slaver near Cuba and fell in love with a black girl called Moira Bell, and they had this daughter called Dido. And he brought her back to England, and he asked his uncle if he would take her into his household and bring her up. And she was brought up at Kenwood House in Hampstead by her great uncle.
How wonderful.
And great aunt.
So he was a big supporter of anti-slavery, I guess.
He supported all minorities, including Catholics. And it just happens that he is most well known for saying that his famous case was called the Somerset case. And he made a judgment that nobody in Britain could be a slave. Once a black person was on British soil, they could no longer be held as a slave because the air in Britain was free.
Goodness. So in one of his sayings, I believe, was let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I think you have to be brave to stick to what you believe is right, even though the world might be very cross with you. And I think that's really what he's trying to say.
Perfect. What a wonderful thing. Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. Wonderful. What an amazing person to be so proud of in your history. And can you tell us any of the stories, Sophie, about how you and your husband, whose first name I think is Alexander, but his name is Mungo, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
But tell us the story about how you and Mungo became the custodians of Scone Palace.
Well, it happened very slowly. My husband inherited the house in 1971, but he was only 14 at the time. And his parents moved in and lived at the palace as his guests from 1971 until 2010. But it wasn't really until 2010 when my mother-in-law left, and my father-in-law was ill by that stage, that I was really able to get to grips with the house.
Tell us of all the things that you're juggling in your home.
You become a jack of all trades. You can't be an expert in anything, unless, of course, it was your previous career, because you're always being dragged from one direction to another. You know, one morning you might be on the roof, and then you might be deciding what plants to put in a certain part of the garden. And you might drive down the road to go somewhere and see a sheep in a field or a fence, a tree fallen down. So every day you're juggling. And I think one of the most important things is to have attention to detail.
What did you do in your younger life, Sophie, before you arrived at school?
I was a very good PA. I say it myself. And I was also a cook and a chef, and I worked in a restaurant. I'd spent a year at Leith School of Food and Wine when they first opened in 1977. And that has stood me in very good stead, knowing how to cook and how a kitchen works.
So being a lady who has culinary expertise, what would your dream meal be?
My dream meal for somebody else to cook for me would be an absolutely delicious, fresh lobster. Half a lobster, sort of cooked in a sort of buttery, lemony sauce That would be a lovely starter.
Tell me what you drink, what you'd have to drink with it, so.
If it was a really, really, very, very special celebration, it would be a Poulinet Morochet or something similar like that. And then I think we would love to, I'd love to have some delicious piece of lamb, Scottish lamb, of course, because Scottish lamb is the best in the world. And then for the lamb, a lovely Saint-Emilion Bordeaux. But this would be for big high days. And followed by a delicious, naughty chocolate something. I don't really mind what it is, whether it's a sort of Okolenghi or a Mary Berry or a Nigella Lawson recipe, I don't really mind, but a delicious bit of chocolate something with Joe Gelato's ice cream. Joe arrived in Persia last year and he got trained in Italy and his ice creams are just to die for.
Oh my word. We're all going to go and try that one. I think you've given us some wonderful tips, Sophie, there.
And then a lovely Sauterne pudding wine. And then if it was Christmas, maybe a delicious port.
A tailor's port.
This year, it was the anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and we found a 1945 bottle of a tailor's port in the cellar, and we opened it up in celebration. And that was a very, very special event.
And apparently you had the Great British Bake Off at Scone, is that right?
Yes, that is absolutely right. It was their first year when it was just a idea with a small production company in 2010. And it was really good fun. And of course, Mary Berry, she had been very famous with her Aga cookbooks in the 70s, but she hadn't been on television that much. And so it was very exciting when Mary came, because I remember we all rushed out with our old Aga cookbooks and got her to sign them.
Oh, fabulous.
They were very talented cooks that year. And there is actually a marvellous cookbook from that year, which has a wonderful carrot cake recipe in it and a wonderful gingerbread recipe in it.
So what other events would you be juggling in your daily work at Scone?
We have quite a few events in the park and the grounds at Scone. We have a music festival called Rewind. We have the Scottish Game Fair. But this coming year, we're going to be doing the Scottish Gardens Show. And this is a completely new event. And that's taking a lot of time. But it's going to be very, very exciting because with COVID and lockdown, we've all been out in our gardens much more. And it's very good for us and very healthy. So it just ticks all the boxes and makes us all want to work even harder to make it a terrific success for Scotland.
So on a normal year, Sophie, how many people would you expect to have around your home?
Excluding the events in the park, I'm about 120,000.
Goodness me.
Per year.
Tell me about this festival that you're running around Halloween.
Spirits of Scone, which sadly we couldn't hold this year, where we have actors in the grounds at Scone and people come jump out and spook you. And it's really, really fun. And we're building that every year. We are very lucky to have a graveyard in our gardens. Not many people have a graveyard in your garden. And we have a maze, and you can have a lot of fun in a maze at Halloween when you want to spook people.
How wonderful. Now, do you, everyone I've spoken to has a different story on this. Do you have any ghosts at Scone?
Well, I've never met any of them, but two of my friends have had experiences. The house was a school during the war, and Cousin Cynthia was at the school, Cynthia Llewellyn Palmer, and she was put into the school san, which is Mrs. McHardy's room, and she definitely felt something. She definitely felt a maid come up and see her when she was lying in bed. Another cousin, Fiona McGregor, she was in one of the guest bedrooms, I won't tell you which, because I wouldn't want people not to want to go in it. I think the room's fine. Actually, I've never slept in the room, I should say, I better try it out. she had an experience in one of those rooms. There's got to be. I mean, you've got, it's such an old building going back to the sort of, 12th, 13th century when it was a abbot's palace and all the kings being crowned. There's got to be.
Spooky stuff. From making this podcast and meeting these women, I have begun to notice the many universal experiences those of us in custodianship share. Hearing things that go bump in the night is certainly one of them. But another common thread is the connection to ancient history and royalty. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, and produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. In this next section, we will be hearing the astonishing story behind the Stone of Destiny, how central Scone was to Scottish royal history, and Lady Mansfield will explain the origins behind one of Scone's greatest treasures, Marie Antoinette's writing desk. But first, I wanted Sophie to bring us back to ancient history and learn more about the previous occupiers of Scone Estate.
Scone Palace sits in this incredible historic and important site. Could you speak about the ancient history of Scone Estate?
The Romans were here in AD 83. There was a settlement at Scone from very early on. It was originally a Christian Chaldee settlement. It then changed to the Augustinians, and they built an abbey church, a very, very, you know, large abbey church with a abbot's palace next door to it. The Moot Hill was a very sort of spiritual area. The Moot Hill is circular, and it would have had a palisade around it, and you would have gone from the secular world to the spiritual world, and everything that happened on the Moot Hill would have been very spiritual, and that's where all the crownings happened and where all the important events happened.
Goodness. Does it still have that rather spiritual feeling to this day?
You definitely feel when you're walking on it that, I mean, you are walking where all these extraordinary people had walked before, that you're walking in the footsteps of, you know, Macbeth and Robert the Bruce. When people ask me about Scone, I often say to them the way to look at it, it's really like Westminster Abbey and Westminster Palace. Scone was the equivalent of Westminster Abbey in Scotland.
Goodness, that's extraordinary. And to live in that in the 21st century must be quite surreal at times.
Completely surreal, and in fact, you know, a terrific honour to carry that history forward.
Absolutely. And I was fascinated reading about this. Is it called the Stone of Destiny?
We call it the Stone of Scone. Yeah, it's an incredible story, and it was here for 500 years, and all the most famous Scottish kings, Malcolm Claymore, Macbeth, Robert the Bruce, were all crowned on the Stone of Scone at Scone. And so it's an incredibly historic site, and it's quite extraordinary that a private family still owns such an incredibly historic site. And a lot of the public still think, you know, it is owned by the state or by the National Trust, because it's so unusual.
Extraordinary. And if we were to have another King of Scotland, would they be crowned on that stone?
I think they would. I think they would, like the Queen, and like Prince Charles will be crowned on the Stone of Scone when he becomes king.
So the original stone is still somewhere at Scone?
It's still somewhere at Scone or in the vicinity. The abbot hid it. Where the original stone is, nobody knows, but I keep looking out whenever we do a bit of digging, whenever we're planting a tree, I'm thinking, where did that abbot hide that stone? It's here somewhere, we just haven't found it.
How fascinating. And can I just ask, how many rooms has your home got?
One of these days I must actually go round and count. I've never counted, but I think it's 120.
Goodness, and so a lot of roof.
A lot of roof. Like we all know, it's the roof that causes all the problems, really. If it's not in good shape, that's when the trouble starts.
And to stand still at Scone, what do the running costs for a year?
Off the top of my head, I can't tell you what the running costs are.
Yeah.
But you can't afford to stand still.
No.
If you stand still, then the house will dilapidate. Yeah. And it won't work.
But I was looking at that the other day from our point of view. By the time you've insured everything, kept it running, so it's running with everything that you need, it's about $500,000 a year at Beaver.
I'm sure.
Then something crops up. There's always something. You think you've done your budget and you've covered everything, every eventuality, and then something crops up, doesn't it?
Something crops up. A ceiling gets a crack.
Yeah.
A flood happens. There's a bad storm.
Yeah.
Something falls down.
Yeah.
Yes. And what the public, I think, don't appreciate is that the income from visiting usually pays for the everyday running costs. and a little bit of maintenance. It never covers capital costs, and that's when the real trouble starts.
And it's only when you live in these homes and you actually do what we do that you realise it's 24/7, never ending, and you have to love it. You have to have a passion for it, for everything that you do, because there is no alternative.
No, there isn't. The only time you relax is when you drive down the drive and go on holiday. Otherwise, you're living above the shop all the time.
Yeah, definitely. And what happened to Scone in the Second World War?
Scone was a girls' school called Craigmount School. They came out from Edinburgh, and I think they all had a riot and had a lovely time. They did cause a bit of damage, which we're still dealing with. The girls were sneaked some food up to the bedrooms and were cooking it and caused a fire, and the fire brigade came. But unfortunately, they brought their big hoses in and they hosed down the state drawing room silks. And there's still, you can still see the water damage on the state drawing room silks to this day. And there's going to be a ghastly moment of truth where they're all going to have to be replaced, because they really, they are beginning to slowly disintegrate, which is very, very, very sad. And I know this story because Bram Salter, who owns Stagecoach, always tells me whenever I meet him, because his father was one of the firemen on the lorry that came and did the hosing.
No.
But they did put out the fire and all the school children were safe. Had it been a normal year, we were going to take 10% off every ticket entry and we were going to put it into the state drawing room silk fund. And it was going to take me about 5 to 7 years to build up enough money to redecorate the state drawing room. But we'll have to start that when the tourists start coming back.
And out of interest, what will the price of doing that silk drawing room be?
About £450,000. It's quite something.
Goodness me.
It's a sort of astronomical amount of money.
It's eye-watering stuff, isn't it? It really is. Well done, Sophie. So you're committed to doing that drawing room as and when things go back to normal.
Absolutely.
What room are you actually sitting in for this interview?
I'm sitting in the Murray Suite. It used to be called the Gothic Rooms. Scone Palace is Georgian Gothic.
And who is the architect of the palace as we know it today?
Atkinson. The house was redone in between 1802 and 1812. Before that time, it really was pretty uncomfortable because the family was having to pay out so much money for fines for looking after the Jacobites, and the roof was leaking and it was all extremely uncomfortable.
So that is a sort of Gothic revival, Regency sort of period.
Yes, Scone's one of the best examples of Georgian Gothic is how it's referred to, because the palace had been a abbot's palace, was to have it have a monastic feel. So it is very similar to going round a church in some respects. You have lots of vaulted ceilings and you have little gargoyles on top of the on some of the pillars as you walk around, and quite a lot of stained glass.
Yeah, so similar in some ways to Beaver. And you have a great connection with Queen Victoria, I believe. Is that right?
In the fact that she came to visit in 1842 on one of her first, if not her first, tour of Scotland. Yes, we had 2 years' warning that she was coming. She writes about us in her diaries. It galvanised the Earl of the day to put in gas, to put in a new drive, and a bridge was put in, especially for Queen Victoria. A whole suite of rooms were made for her. And she stayed for one night. But that was all perfectly normal those days. I always say to people, thank God it wasn't Queen Elizabeth I, because that they really did completely cripple you if they came to stay.
How amazing. And she bought Balmoral as a result of falling in love with this part of the world. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. She and old Prince Albert just adored the Scottish countryside.
Amazing. If you look and see, there's a picture over on my right here of this rather voluptuous looking lady with a feather sticking out of her head.
Yes.
Who is the mother of the first Marquess of Granby. And I always find it fascinating as you grow into these houses, learning about the people behind the portraits.
Oh, there's so much to learn. I mean, there is so, so much to learn, and I would love to spend more time up in the archives. I mean, you can disappear into the archives for weeks and never appear. But being busy women like you and me, we don't have so much time to disappear into our archives.
Yeah. If you were to think about your home, Sophie, what would be some of your very favourite heirlooms and works of art?
That's so easy, because if there was a fire, I'd be carrying the Dido Bell picture out of the house. I think the Dido Bell and Lady Elizabeth Murray picture is just simply gorgeous, and the story behind it is unbelievable. And this lovely portrait shows them off beautifully. And it was recently attributed by Philip Mould and Fiona Bruce from the Fake or Fortune programme on the BBC as being by David Martin, who was a pupil of Alan Ramsay and one of the most famous Scottish portrait painters.
Gosh, that's fabulous. And you have a very famous writing desk, is that right?
Yes, we do. The second Earl of Mansfield, when he was Viscount Stormont, was as distinguished, really, as the first Earl of Mansfield, but in the field of diplomacy. He was in Paris when Marie Antoinette was there. And Marie Antoinette felt very comfortable with him because she had known him when he was the ambassador in Vienna for her parents. So he was a friendly face when he was then moved from Vienna to Paris. And in fact, he was called La Belle Anglaise. They became friends, and she gave him a beautiful little Reisner writing desk from the Chateau of Marly, which is one of our prized possessions.
How fabulous. Have you ever sat down to that desk, Sophie, and written the letter?
No. I haven't. I hardly dare touch it. But perhaps I should do it just once.
How amazing. Just once. Because all these things are about living in heritage, aren't they? It's so easy to make it a museum. And of course, I always feel one of the great things about families like yours and ours is that we actually live in heritage. How did you find that, bringing your children up in a place that is very much open to the public, and you're juggling your life and their lives, like living in a merry-go-round sometimes, isn't it?
You just get used to people, and I think some people find it difficult, but I don't really mind at all. It's no different than walking out of your house in a street and going down the road and bumping into somebody else. These big houses need people. They weren't built just to be lived in by a couple of old people rattling around. These houses need life. They need people. They only come alive when people are in it. You can only experience that if you've actually been in it when it's quiet and nobody's there. And then when it's full of people, you actually love it when there's lots of people around. And it's really sad when there aren't people.
You appear to me to be a very open lady, and you absolutely cherish sharing your home with the public. And did you sort of, during COVID, put the dust sheets on and just forget it and say, right, no cleaners, no everyone, just draw up the drawbridge and let's pull in our belts and get through this?
And that's exactly what happened at Scone. There were no cleaners. The dust sheets went down, but I was still paranoid about moth getting in. So all the family were put to work hoovering all the rooms. Outside, I took up mowing, and that was fun. It's rather fun driving a large mower. It takes 3.5 hours to mow the front drive. So the head gardener and I had the whole place sorted. We did half each, and it was fun. I got a bit of a suntan. Every now and then I got wet.
Great. And how many acres of garden have you got, Sophie?
We have just over 100 acres of garden. So there's quite a lot to do, but there are a lot of trees and a lot of shrubs, but there's a lot to manage.
And I was fascinated to see your voluntary programme that you're doing, Sophie. That's fabulous. Explain what you're doing with that.
It's been a great success, and Brian, our head gardener, runs it and leads it. We have about 17 volunteers who are all ages, but predominantly retired, and they come on the days of the week that Brian wants them or suits them, and they're really enjoying the challenge of helping us in the gardens and then seeing the results of their labours. And they are doing the most marvellous work in the gardens, and we really couldn't do without them. And with everybody wanting to get out and about and, you know, fresh air and healthy exercise, it ticks their boxes and our boxes. So it's a very, very happy relationship.
That's absolutely exactly what's happened here at Beaver. So we obviously don't have the numbers that you do, and things were very tough this year. And so I had to make an executive decision that we were going to have to recruit volunteers to come and help us with the house opening through the season. And that has blown my mind, how the people that have come to join us, they feel so part of this building and so passionate about wanting to help. It's a very different mindset, and so I'm very encouraged, hugely grateful for everything that everyone's doing to support us, keep the roof on here at Beaver. So, Sophie, do you feel a responsibility to preserve the house for future generations? And if so, What would you like people to take away from their experience of Scone Palace?
I'd like them to take away a sense of history. I'd like them to take away that the palace is alive, that we are it's a modern, family, a modern business, that we are moving forward. We're looking after our heritage as well as getting to grips with becoming a modern rural business.
I've got one very special question I'd love to put to you, Sophie. And this is something that I ask all the girls that I've been interviewing. If sitting in that chair today, in this historic bit of British history, what would you say to the women of Scone six generations in the past?
I mean, they definitely had their challenges, because I think my husband's family did have their ups and downs, and there were times when they were struggling too. So I think they would look at me and think, keep on going, girl. And I don't know what I would be saying to them, but I bet they were grafting away all those years ago too.
And then for six generations into the future, what would you actually say?
You still here? Lord knows what's going to happen six generations into the future. We might be all living on the moon.
Lovely answer, Sophie. You're the best. But I guess I always think about that one and think, as long as you're making it work and you're running it and it's not running you, because so often these great piles can sort of chew you up and spit you out. And so getting on top of the job is the most important thing, I think.
Yep. That's absolutely right. You've just got to keep steady.
Steady head.
Keep steady and keep trying. Yep. Keep steady.
That's great.
Don't panic.
Wonderful. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And I think Scone Palace is incredibly lucky just to have such a devoted, charming lady as yourself, the Countess of Mansfield. It's been a joy. Thank you, Sophie, for your time.
Thank you too. I've enjoyed it very much.
Continues to move me so much in doing this podcast is learning again and again how central these homes are to the cultural and national identity of those who live in their orbit, even to this day. It's wonderful to hear that Scone continues to act as a unifying image, and how, even in difficult times, it continues to bring people together. Lady Mansfield, thank you so much for your insight and your warmth. Thank you for bringing us into your fabulous home. And thank you all listeners at home who've enjoyed this wonderful experience. Next time, I will be speaking to the incredible Countess of Devon about her wonderful home, Powdram Castle. The Countess opens up about her career in Hollywood, her boundary-pushing plans for Powdram in the future, and she gives us her advice for Meghan Markle. Couple of quick notes before we go. Important ones. Make sure you subscribe to Duchess the podcast so you get automatically notified about new episodes wherever you listen to a podcast. I want to know about you and what you think of the show, so please be sure to send me your comments and tell me about your own lineage and the women who have inspired you in your life. Please write to me on duchess@duchessthepodcast.com. And if there are any stately homes in particular you'd like me to visit, do send your suggestions to me as soon as possible. I've started a newsletter that includes all this and more and comes straight to your inbox. It's really easy to sign up at duchessthepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast, presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Lady Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofies and Theo Banner. Thanks for listening to Duchess, the podcast.